Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present political economist and activist Chris Rood, who takes a critical look at President Obama's recent proposal to cut corporate taxes while closing loopholes. Patty Bloom of the Center for Justice and Accountability, who discusses a Florida judge's decision that could lead to the deportation of a former Salvadoran general for war crimes. And Peter Montgomery, senior fellow with People for the American Way, who talks about the revival of Christian right culture war issues in the 2012 presidential election campaign. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after the uprising in Tahrir Square, former TV host Bathania Kamel is running a long-shot campaign for president of Egypt as the only female candidate. She doesn't have any handlers as she campaigns and is often confronted by groups of men asking, why is she running for office? After recent parliamentary elections were swept by Islamic parties, Kamel remains one of the few voices calling for fundamental democratic reforms in Egypt, which is currently run by a military tribunal. During the height of the protests in Tahrir Square, women were on the barricades with pro-democracy activists. But the army council, which took over after President Mubarak resigned, forced some women activists to undergo virginity tests. In December, soldiers beat female activists and ripped off the clothes and exposed a blue bra of one activist, which caused an uproar in socially conservative Egypt. After the incident, 3,000 women marched to protest police harassment. But protests ended after members of the Muslim Brotherhood Party objected to the women's march and said it was time for women to abandon the barricades. Thus far, the Muslim Brotherhood has not appointed any women to its legal council, and many Brotherhood members strongly object to the idea of a woman or a Christian ever becoming president of Egypt. Pro-democracy blogger Gihan Ibrahim, who was shot with a rubber bullet in Tahrir Square last year, declared women want their rights represented on divorce, maternity issues, and custody of children. She says, "We want a civil, secular state." The Volcker Rule, named after former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, would ban proprietary trading by big banks that enjoy government protection and financing. But a proposed regulation to enforce the Volcker Rule has gotten bogged down in confusing details, vague language, and exemptions. According to some observers, the current 536-page proposal has lost focus on limiting risky trading by Wall Street banks and investment houses that triggered the 2008 financial crash. Dennis Kelleher, head of the pro-reform group Better Markets, called the proposed rule the bastard child of the lobbying industry. He asserted that the length and complexity of the proposal are only in there because of industry lobbying. Reformers say government regulators are also at fault for writing the overly complex regulation. Activists are calling for the Securities and Exchange Commission to come up with a simple, understandable regulation that would give the Volcker Rule some teeth and prevent risky trades that could explode and damage the financial system. Occupy the SEC, a reform group, urged regulators not to confuse mere complexity with nuance. Simple, bright-line rules make the compliance process easier, both for the regulated and for the regulator. The drive in Arizona to send more inmates to private prisons is costing taxpayer money and making prisons more difficult to monitor, concludes a new report by the American Friends Service Committee. Between 2008 and 2010, Arizona taxpayers paid $10 million more for private prison beds than it would have cost to house inmates in state prisons. Arizona is planning to send an additional 2,000 more inmates to private prisons owned by the Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group at a cost of $38 million. Prison reform groups also question the level of safety inside privately run prisons. In the past 3 years, Arizona has had 28 prison riots and 2,000 violent incidents involving 50 inmates or more. Most of these incidents were not disclosed to the public. Inexperienced prison staff may have led to a riot at the privately run Kingman Prison in 2010, where a witness said guards did nothing to stop a large group of white inmates from attacking black prisoners. Phoenix Democratic State Representative Chad Campbell has filed several bills to monitor private prisons, but none of the proposals are expected to receive a public hearing in the Republican-controlled Arizona State Legislature. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zofia Hunter.
A report issued in 2010 by President Barack Obama's National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform recommended an overhaul of the nation's complex and loophole-ridden tax code. Although the commission's recommendations were not adopted by Congress, the president put forward one element of the plan on February 22nd that would reform corporate tax rates. The president proposed cutting the top corporate taxes from 35% to 28%, with a 25% drop for U.S.-based manufacturers. Concurrently, the plan would also eliminate many loopholes that had allowed some of the nation's largest corporations to pay little or no taxes at all. But the administration maintains that their proposal would remain revenue neutral, meaning that corporations under their plan would pay no more taxes in the future than they're paying now. The effective corporate tax rate in the U.S. is at the lowest level they've been in some 40 years. The Congressional Budget Office reported that taxes paid on corporate profits in 2011 averaged 12.1% as compared to 25.6% paid between 1987 and 2008. Another estimate found that corporate taxes as a percentage of federal government revenues fell from 32% in 1953 to just 10% today. As the birth of the Occupy Wall Street movement has provoked protest and debate about growing income inequality in the U.S., many economists and progressive activists have criticized the president's plan for not increasing the tax burden on large corporations that are now holding an estimated $2 trillion in cash. Your reporter spoke with Chris Rood, a political economist who has worked for both the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and on Wall Street. Here, Rood, who currently is active with the Occupy Wall Street movement, takes a critical look at President Obama's corporate tax cut plan.
It does reduce the corporate tax rate from 35% to 28%. But on the other hand, it also pretends to be revenue neutral, which means it's designed not to raise the taxes on corporation in total, but rather to have the total amount of taxes raised from the corporate sector remain unchanged. It reduces the overall tax rate, as I said, by a certain percentage. And what it's revenue neutral by eliminating a certain kind of tax loopholes. Three in particular are important. Under current law, corporations are allowed to full deduct all their interest costs. This bill eliminates the tax deductibility of interest costs for corporations. Also, under current law, something which is known as carried interest is not taxed. Carried interest is basically the kind of fees which hedge fund managers get, and it's taxed at a very low tax rate, namely around 15%. And finally, the Obama proposal eliminates certain incentives for corporations to basically keep their foreign profits abroad so that they're not taxed. Under current law, the foreign profits of multinational corporations are not taxed until they're, quote, returned home. The difficulty with the overall proposal is that it's revenue neutral. It doesn't raise taxes. And what Obama's proposal does, and I could put all the other Republican proposals in the same category, I would call them basically kind of a pre-election posturing. And what all these proposals avoid talking about is what's going to happen after after the election is over. And if we recall, one of the things which is still left hanging in the air are the Bush tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts were set to expire and then renewed basically under Obama, and they're set to expire again, and they will expire after the election is over, leaving a budget hole in the budget roughly over the next decade, or according to the Congressional Budget Office, about $633 billion, which is going to have to be filled somehow, and presumably what the powers that be are mandating or what happened, I'd include probably Obama in this, is to have that gap, that $633 billion gap in the budget, be filled by spending cuts.
Chris, you want to speak to the shift in the tax burden? What was the effective tax rate on big corporations around the country going back to the Eisenhower administration, and what percentage of taxes do they pay these days? And how does that affect income inequality that Occupy Wall Street and many people around the country have a growing concern about?
Well, comporting tax rates is a controversial estimate, controversial procedure. What I've simply done, I've simply taken corporate taxes and divided them by corporate income. And basically, around 1949, 1950, the average corporate tax rate was around 50%. And right now, in a current date, and recently as 2010, it's basically around 22%. And similarly, the tax rates for wealthy individuals have been cut significantly. Highest tax rates for the top highest individuals were basically around 70% throughout the 60s, and right now they're around 30%. So there's a slight progressivity to personal income taxes now, but it's much, much less so than it was in the past.
If you were to put proposals on the table to remake our tax system to be fairer and to be a boost for the economy generally, what important elements would you propose?
Well, on the budget, there's always two sides of the equations. I mean, it's always the tax side and the expenditure side. I think we should have significant increases in corporate taxes and taxes on high-income individuals. I would also impose a steep transactions tax. We have a financial system which is based on trading, not long-term investment. A significant reform would be to tax transactions, tax creation of credit, of derivatives, all forms. And we could also, that'd be a nice source of income as well. And on the spending side, I'm in favor of a national health care system, a national pension system. I think we should have free university educational system. There's no reason why students should get in debt as they are nowadays because of our private universities are so expensive. And I think we need to really think our public housing system. You know, we're in a situation where one of the causes of our crisis is in the housing industry and the problem of mortgages. And we have to really think in serious ways in which we're going to create housing for all of us. There's no reason why anybody should be homeless.
That was Chris Rood, a political economist who serves on the steering committee of the Union for Radical Political Economics and is active with the Occupy Wall Street movement. Find links to more analysis and commentary on tax policy on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A U.S. immigration judge last week approved the deportation of General Carlos Eugenio Vides Casanova, who from 1980 to 1989 served as head of El Salvador's National Guard and later as defense minister during the nation's bloody civil war, when tens of thousands of Salvadoran civilians were murdered and many were tortured. On February 23rd, Judge James Grimm of Orlando, Florida's Immigration Court found Vides Casanova liable for acts of torture and murder committed by soldiers under his command, including the rape and murder of four American churchwomen in December 1980. At the time, Washington was supporting the Salvadoran government's war against the FMLN leftist guerrilla movement. In deciding the case, the judge cleared the way for the former general's deportation from the U.S. General Casanova was also found to have assisted in the torture of two Salvadorans who testified at the proceedings and were represented by the Center for Justice and Accountability. The case was prosecuted by the Human Rights Violators and War Crimes Center, part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Vides Casanova has denied participation in or even knowledge of these crimes. He has several avenues of appeal still open to him before a final judgment is rendered. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Carolyn Patty Bloom, senior legal advisor to the Center for Justice and Accountability. She explains how her organization was able to win a 2002 civil judgment in settlement of $300,000 from Vides Casanova on behalf of three Salvadoran torture victims, and discusses the importance of this most recent immigration court decision.
We kept the Immigration Service and then the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice aware of Vides' presence in the U.S. and encouraging them and encouraging members of Congress who had an interest to put pressure on the Department of Homeland Security to remove him from the United States so that he would not, you know, be able to continue to live here, both after a successful civil judgment against him, finding him responsible for our client's torture, but, you know, also because of the position that he held in the El Salvadoran military.
You said the Center for Justice and Accountability got involved in a legislative effort to make it easier to remove human rights abusers from the U.S., and that passed in 2004. How does it work?
This is the legislation that amended the Immigration and Nationality Act. And how it amended it was to enable the Department of Homeland Security to give them more tools to deport people who were accused of ordering, inciting, assisting, or otherwise participating in torture or extrajudicial assassination. I would say, you know, in all frankness, that during the period that Bush was in office, the lens was turned much more toward terrorism. There were people who were in kind of an overlapping units who were dealing both with domestic terrorism, quote unquote, and so-called human rights abusers. And the human rights abusers kind of portfolio sort of got dropped by the wayside. And it really wasn't until the Obama administration came in and there was a bit of more of a revival of the office of people who were committed to really looking at this array of human rights abusers from various countries who were in the United States, El Salvador, Colombia, Guatemala, Honduras, Rwanda, Bosnia, Liberia, I mean, a number of different places. And, you know, there have been pretty consistent reporting that there were, in fact, a number of human rights abusers in the U.S. We knew, certainly from the cases of the defendants that had lost the cases that we had litigated, which were focused on El Salvador. It got a better recognition, and there were people in Congress who were very supportive, both in terms of passing the legislation, making sure that it would be implemented, and holding hearings.
Patty Blum, how significant is this ruling from the immigration judge regarding Vides Casanova?
It's the first time that the Department of Homeland Security has used it against a person who was at the absolute top senior position in military command. And so for that reason, it's quite significant that they went forward against him and that the judge rendered a decision against him and found him responsible for participating or assisting in the torture of two of our clients who testified at the immigration judge hearing and for the assassination of the four American church women and of two other Americans who were killed with an El Salvadoran land reform activist.
Is the idea that he would be deported back to El Salvador and that he'd stand trial there?
The ultimate end game of this is that he would be returned to El Salvador. And while he may not face any type of prosecution in El Salvador, currently he wouldn't, but things could change in El Salvador.
And that's because of the amnesty that's in place?
Yes. He has been living in the United States for a long time. His family is here. It would be, I'm sure, from his perspective, a real punishment to have to leave the United States.
Would you say that it's becoming more possible to get judgments against some of the Central American military leaders of the 1970s and 80s, you know, who are now living in the U.S.?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that things have really changed dramatically internationally over the past 15 years. There really has developed an international movement to oppose impunity and to demand accountability for crimes that occurred in the past, even when there's a transition to a new, more democratic system.
That was Carolyn Patty Bloom with the Center for Justice and Accountability. For more information on the case of General Vides Casanova, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the U.S. economy in the worst shape since the Great Depression, economic issues were an obvious focus for debate among the presidential candidates in this year's election campaign. But in recent weeks, Republican candidates running for the White House have veered toward issues favored by the Christian right that include opposition to abortion and gay marriage. But what's been a surprise to many observers is the recent attention to the long-settled issue of women's access to contraception, which has not been seriously debated in U.S. politics since the Supreme Court settled the landmark Griswold v. Connecticut case in 1965, in which the justices ruled that the U.S. Constitution protected a right to privacy, overturning a Connecticut law that banned the use of contraceptives. With the exception of Representative Ron Paul, GOP candidates Rick Santorum, Mitt Romney, and Newt Gingrich have all to some degree challenged the ability of women to access contraception under President Obama's health care reform law. The controversy first erupted after the president issued a ruling mandating that employers, with the exception of churches themselves, provide free contraceptives to their female employees. Because Catholic institutions that serve the public, such as hospitals and universities, were included, Catholic bishops objected, causing the president to offer a compromise that shifted the responsibility to offer contraceptives to insurance companies. While public opinion polls found wide support for Mr. Obama's position, a Republican bill now making its way through Congress would allow any employer to withdraw insurance coverage for any medical procedure or treatment that they had a moral objection to. The introduction of legislation in Virginia that would force women seeking abortions to undergo medically unnecessary transvaginal ultrasounds sparked widespread protest and attention to the Republican Party's allegiance to the agenda of the radical Christian right. Your reporter spoke with Peter Montgomery, senior fellow with the group People for the American Way, who talks about some reasons behind the revival of Christian right culture war issues in the 2012 presidential election campaign.
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. One, I think that the economic news has in some ways been getting better for the country in terms of, you know, numbers about job creation and unemployment and consumer confidence and business confidence. So for, you know, the Republican candidates who thought that they were going to cruise through on the basis of hard economic times are a little worried that that might not stand them through November. And so I think that's partly why we're getting this increased focus on, you know, social issues and, you know, this bogus claim that the Obama administration is engaged in a war on religion or a war on religious liberty. You know, that's the kind of rhetoric we're used to seeing from, you know, the fringes of the religious right, and now we're hearing it from presidential candidates and bishops and all kinds of folks.
Is the message we're hearing from any of these candidates as they bring up abortion, contraception, the so-called Obama administration's war on religion, is that having any resonance with the American public at large? Or is the rhetoric from the GOP candidates really targeted at a very narrow spectrum of voters who will be casting ballots in the Republican primaries alone?
Well, I think there's two different things going on here. I think that you're right that in the Republican primaries, you know, what's happening is that all the candidates seem to be competing to see who can prove themselves to be furthest to the right in order to energize those conservative voters who make up the bulk of the Republican Party base and the people who are most likely to go vote in the primaries. And so, you know, we have Santorum as well as Gingrich and Romney, you know, accusing Obama of waging a war on religious liberty. And Santorum is sort of the most out there with his rhetoric, you know, in his comment this weekend that John F. Kennedy's speech on separation of church and state made him want to throw up. It's just kind of the most colorful of his rhetoric. So I think that's what's going on for the Republican primary. And then I think in the big picture, people like the Catholic bishops and the National Organization for Marriage, who have been really upset about the advance of marriage equality in the country and gay rights generally, and they have been trying to portray gay rights and religious liberty as somehow inherently in conflict. And I think that's partly because they're losing the war of public opinion when it comes to LGBT equality. Most Americans support equality for gay people, and younger Americans overwhelmingly do so. And I think they're trying to change the conversation and make it a conversation about something that Americans also value, which is religious liberty. And that's why we've also seen them try to turn their criticism of the Obama administration's health care and regulations on contraception into claims that the administration is hostile to religious liberty. I think it's just an effort to use rhetoric that taps into a value most Americans do have, which is supporting religious liberty. I just think it's not accurate and it's misleading.
I wanted to talk to you about the changing demographics in the country. And if you think the Republican Party's employment of culture war issues will be successful this time around in the 2012 campaign, as it was for George W. Bush and his advisor Karl Rove in both the 2000 and 2004 elections, where they used guns, gods, and gays as their basic strategy to make sure that their voters, their base of Christian right and conservative voters, came out to the polls in the presidential elections in those years. What kind of luck do you think they'll have with those issues this time around?
You know, I don't really think it's going to work. They certainly have a chunk of their base voters that they can motivate with that, and they may do that and try to turn people out. But if you look at the broader electorate and including, you know, independent voters who are really keys to winning the election, opinions are changing a lot. You know, even on, just for example, on the issue of equality for LGBT people and equality for same-sex couples, it's really dramatic changes of public opinion in the last 10 years and last 20 years. And so, you know, the kind of strident anti-gay rhetoric that we're seeing may appeal to and energize a big chunk of the Republican Party base, but it's not the way you're going to win over independent voters or the majority of the public. And so I think they're playing a losing game in that regard. And again, it gets back to that conundrum of the party itself having moved so far to the right and the sort of core activists of the party sort of having embraced this no compromise ideology requires people running for office to go so far right in the primary that I think they're going to damage their general election prospects.
That was Peter Montgomery, senior fellow with People for the American Way. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to find more information on the Christian right inspired culture war in U.S. politics. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Sophia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.